So we have witnessed the baptisms of Adam and Andrew. I wonder if any of us felt offended by what just happened. And if we didn't, if that seems like a strange question to ask, if we didn't feel anything, even a slight hint of offence within us at what we've witnessed, we maybe need to understand it a little bit better. They say that buying a house is a very stressful thing. Isn't it, Heidi? Usually it's a very long, drawn-out process. So imagine you've been saving your money for decades to buy a house. And you have your heart set on this particular house. You have your heart set on it so much that you start to call it my house. And you go through the long process of buying it, and eventually your offer is accepted, and eventually you get to the day when the contract is to be exchanged. And on that day, you get a call from the estate agent saying, the buyer has decided to give the house to someone they met in the pub the night before. Someone who wasn't looking to buy a house, who doesn't need a house, and especially someone who didn't need your house. Wonder what that would feel like. You deserve that house. You've worked for it. You've saved for it. You've gone through the right process of getting the house. You've done everything right in the purchasing process. Everything you'd put in place, and suddenly your house is taken by someone who blatantly did not deserve it. It would feel horrible, wouldn't it? And if we can just understand a little bit of why that might feel so wrong to us, we might just begin to get what's happening at the start of Luke 15. Nikki read for us from the second half of Luke 15, this story Jesus tells about the father and the two sons. But what kicks it off is what happens at the beginning of the chapter. And if you have your Bibles open, you can read it. The beginning of the chapter, it says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering round to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. There are two groups of people at the beginning of the chapter. The tax collectors and the sinners. The tax collectors who were all about the money. They were in it for the money. They didn't care who got hurt. They just wanted more of the money. They were scumbags. And the sinners, well, they were the bad people. Everyone knew they were the bad people. In our society, there'd be, I know, the gangsters, the drug dealers, terrorists. People we know are bad. That's one group. And then the second group, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Now these are those who try to do their best all of the time. That they're always trying to do the right thing. They're always working hard to live the best possible life. The religious elite of the time, known for their great efforts in personal piety. And this group, the second group, muttered. They grumbled. And the reason for their discontent, but the reason they're so bothered is that that first group, that group of awful and undeserving lowlives, they're gathering round to hear Jesus. And worst of all, Jesus is not distancing himself. He's not sending them away. He's welcoming them and he's eating with them. Now these Pharisees who spend all of their time working really, really hard so they can do the right thing and be accepted by God. And then Jesus, who claims to be God's son, he comes among them and he starts welcoming people who self-evidently do not deserve to be welcomed. So Jesus speaks to their complaint. He responds to their grumbling by telling three stories. He's not trying to entertain them with stories, he's trying to teach them. The first is a story of a lost sheep, the second about a lost coin, and then the third, the longest story, kind of pulls together the first two into something maybe more concrete, maybe more challenging. I think when we look at this story that Jesus tells that was read for us, so one of the things that it helps us with is it helps us to understand a bit better what sin is. Sin isn't a word that's often used outside church. But even inside church, we can get a bit tangled up with what it means. But these stories are all about sinners. We're told that at the start. That's why Jesus tells the story, because there are these Pharisees who see this group of people welcomed by Jesus, and they identify the group of people as sinners. But the Pharisees seem to know what sin is. They can identify, they can put a label on a group of people and say, this is what they are. But what is it? So what would you say that sin is? How do you define it? What does it look like? You see, I wonder if these Pharisees, in their thinking, is a bit like using a hammer to do a job that an axe is designed for. Yesterday we had a barbecue. And when I make a barbecue, I don't like to use fire lighters. I like to do it properly. It's a good barbecue if you use one match. And yesterday was a good barbecue. Now, in order to get it started, you've got to get some kindling. You've got to get some wood, little bits of wood. And you know, the traditional method of making kindling is to use an axe. But I'm not traditional, so I use a hammer. On reflection, it's not a very sensible way to make kindling. It's probably quite dangerous to replace your axe with a hammer. But that's what I did. But I wonder if our thinking about sin can be like that. We use a hammer instead of an axe. I wonder if that's what the Pharisees are doing. They've got this big, blunt category for sinners. And they stick that label onto certain people. But then Jesus' story is like taking away the hammer and giving an axe. Something more precise. Something that sharpens our understanding of what sin is. Now Jesus tells about the behavior of the younger son, and it helps us to understand what sin is. This is what Jesus says in the story. The younger son, said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. Now this story is a story all about relationship. It's all about the son's relationship with their father. And Jesus in that is showing us that when we come to think about sin, we must first of all think about relationship. This younger son, he wants life away from his father. That's why he asked for the inheritance. He can't wait for his dad to die. He wants to get his hands on the money so he can be away from his father. He wants to be free from his father, free from the influence of his father. He wants nothing more to do with his father. He breaks the relationship. Because sin is about relationship. Then as soon as he gets away, we discover what he's searching for. And Jesus calls it wild living. He's searching for happiness. He wanted to be happy. That doesn't sound that bad, does it, really? What's wrong with wanting to be happy? I think in some sense we're all searching for that. We're all looking for happiness. Now the question is, though, we must ask, what does a search for happiness mean in the context of relationship? Or we could say, how tenable is his search for happiness when he has run away from his father? That's the point Jesus makes. He makes it very plainly that this son thinks he knows what will make him happy, so he goes for it, he grasps for it. He defines for himself what his life is to be like, and he goes after it, he runs away, and then it fails catastrophically. And because his search for happiness was misplaced. And he realizes that. When he comes to his senses, he realizes that. He remembers that all he needs is available in his father's home. And that he realizes that if he's going to put things right, he has to get back to his father. It's relational. And for us, if we think that sin is just about some moral code, if we think that sin is just about kind of breaking a set of rules or doing bad things, Jesus' story pushes us to think more deeply. And the Bible tells us fundamentally people are made for relationship with God. And the Bible tells us also that we've done something very similar to what the younger son did. Taken the gifts of God, gifts of life, of food, of shelter, of pleasures, families. We've taken all the gifts, but we've pushed God away. We want his presence, but he's not present. So we take the gifts and we refuse the giver. We decide for ourselves what will make us happy. And then we go for it. And we invest ourselves in it. And then we find we've run away from our original home. It's the way the Bible describes the story of the human race. The story that we're all born into. And whether or not we accept that as an explanation, it does put its finger on something deep inside us, on that nagging suspicion that we've just missed something. This is how C.S. Lewis puts it. He writes, "Most people, if they really learn how to look into their own hearts, would know that they do want, and want acutely, something that cannot be had in this world. There are all sorts of things in this world that offer to give it to you, but they never keep their promise. The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or first think of some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings which no marriage, no travel, no learning can really satisfy. I'm not speaking of what would ordinarily be called unsuccessful marriages or trips and so on. I'm speaking of the best possible ones. That there is always something we grasped at in the first moment of longing that just fades away in the reality. The spouse may be a good spouse, the scenery has been excellent, he turned out to be a good job, but it has evaded us." Or as C.S. Lewis's friend Tolkien puts it more succinctly, he says that at our best, our whole nature is still soaked with a sense of exile. That under the surface, in ways that we might not even quite be able to explain, we are yearning for our homeland. And do you see what they're getting at? So this younger son is obviously searching for happiness, but it fails him. It's a bit like trying to build a house on Mars. So you could build an exact replica of your house from Earth on Mars. You could replace it brick for brick. You could arrange all the furniture exactly how it is on Earth. It could look exactly the same. But if there's no atmosphere on the planet, you can't live there for very long. So the younger son tries to build this life that is unsustainable. And I think one of the really shocking things in Jesus' story is in the crisis of this son, he has got what he asked for. He grasps for it. He gets what he wants, but when he gets it, it's terribly disappointing. And we find that this boy, with his money spent, is sitting in a field of pigs, longing to eat their food, and he's utterly alone. Now, for those who Jesus first told this story to, that would be the worst thing they can imagine. Pigs were unclean animals. To sit in a field of pigs, wanting to eat their food. That we're only friends of pigs and they won't share their food with you. Now the son describes the situation by saying, "Here I am starving to death." And literally he says, "Here I am perishing. I'm utterly lost." And it's the same word that's used in all three stories about the lost sheep. They're so far from home, you might as well just write it off. Or the lost coin that you can't find, you might as well just give up and forget about it. And now this son, he is so lost, he's sitting in a field of pigs. Jesus wants us to be in no doubt at all that life without God is no life at all. Even if that's the life that we've chosen. Now C.S. Lewis again puts it quite perceptively when he says there are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says in the end, "Thy will be done." Now, if you don't want God to be part of your life, the terrible reality is that you will get just that. And we've all got to ask just how tenable that would be. And in the midst of wild living, or whatever that means for us, defining our own way in the world, we might not think about home very often, but sooner or later it will come nagging. Now, can we be sure that it's not going to all come undone? Now, Jesus tells about the younger son to help us understand what sin is, to show fundamentally that it's about relationship with God and that within that sin is a misplaced search for happiness, a looking for the pot of gold at the bottom of the rainbow. Because we were made for God and our hearts are restless until they find rest in Him. But then there's another thing that the young son shows us. Now when he comes to his senses and he's sitting in the pig's field, he reasons like this. He says, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So the son is on the turn here. It's his first step on the way back home. This is a good point in the story. And yet here we perhaps see a hint of the reason why he left his father in the first place. And that reason is that he just didn't know his father very well. Now, he's right in the story to realize that all his needs will be supplied in his father's home. He's right to turn his steps back on the way that he's come. And yet his plan is to go back as a hired laborer. His plan is to earn his way back into his father's favor. It's as though he wants to go back and say to his father, I owe you a lot. I'm not sure I can ever repay you, but I want to make a start. And maybe over time my debt can gradually be decreased. He didn't know his father very well. And yet it's that attitude in the younger son, wanting to pay his way, that brings the spotlight to the end of the story, to the older brother. So we could say, on one hand, the brothers are chalk and cheese, aren't they? The younger one, he's a rebel who runs away. The older one, he's a goody two-shoes who stays at home and obeys all the rules. And yet actually, deep down, these brothers are more similar than they realize. So just as the younger son helps us to understand what sin is, the older son helps us to understand what sin is. So we meet this older son at the end coming back from the field. So we're to picture him having done a hard day's work for his father on the land. Back-breaking toil again and again and again. He's coming back from the field after a day's work. And he hears this party. He asks what's happening. And the news is devastating. Your brother has come, he's told. The brother who wanted our father dead. The brother who took all the money and ran away and we've not heard, he's come back. So surely this party is a celebration of his public flogging as the little twerp gets what he deserves. But the news gets worse. Your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. It's too much. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. Remember that sin is fundamentally relational. Now, how does the older brother view his relationship with his father? You see how he refuses to enter the house? You see how he considers that the relationship is not a father and son relationship? He is a slave. Those are his words. So the younger son thought he must pay his way back into his father's favor. Now the older son thought he'd already done enough to deserve his father's property. Both of them miscalculated just how generous their father was. Both of them were using their father to get the things they desired. Now the younger does it blatantly. The older is more subtle, but it's the same thing. He's fixed on getting the wealth of the father rather than enjoying relationship with the father. And you hear it in his words, don't you, when he says, you never gave me even a goat so I could celebrate with my friends. Now, apart from the fact that everything of the father was available to him, his desire was to celebrate with his friends. And it's a stark contrast to the celebration that is happening right at that time, a father celebrating with his son. The older son doesn't want that. The father can pick up the tab at the end of the evening. It's like the story of the man who grew some carrots in his garden. So one year, the carrots were superb. And one of them in particular was huge, healthy, prize-winning carrot. And the man was so impressed with the carrot that he'd grown, he thought, I'm going to give this as a present to the king. So he takes it and he gives the carrot to the king. And the king says, that's a great carrot. You obviously know what you're doing. I'm going to give you one of my fields to see what else you can do. And the man goes off to enjoy his field. And one of the officials there, he sees this and he thinks, that man gave a carrot and he got a field in exchange. So he has an idea. The next day he comes to the king and he says to the king, O king, I breed horses and this is the finest stallion from my stables. You can have it as a gift. The king says thanks and he takes the horse. And then there's silence. And the man waits. It gets a bit embarrassing. The king says, was there something else? And the man says, well, look, yesterday that chap gave you a carrot and you gave him a field in exchange. Today I've given you a horse. So, and the king says, no, The difference is, that man gave me the carrot, you gave yourself the horse. See? The older brother isn't interested in relationship with his father. He's searching for happiness apart from his father. His father is a means to the end, just like the younger son at the beginning. Because sin is always relational. And these two brothers, they show that sin can look like a rebel who runs away, or sin can look like a do-gooder who thinks that he can win the gifts of God and bypass relationship with the giver. And all of that really turns this trio of stories into the faces of the Pharisees to whom Jesus is speaking. Now, they are the older brother, of course, angry and grumbling because the younger brother, the tax collectors and sinners, have been welcomed by Jesus. But sin is relational. Pushing away from God, trying to live out of relationship with him, trying to find life and happiness without him, trying to define your own way in the world, trying to win your own way. And the problem with both brothers is that they didn't know their father very well. And that's a question we've got to ask ourselves, isn't it? And how well do we know the Father? And how well do we really know God? And I wonder how much the God that we believe in, or even the God we don't believe in, is like the God that Jesus is trying to tell us about here. Now, these brothers had him down as one whose favor must be earned, and they were very wrong. At Glastonbury, last week, the week before, Stormzy, a grime artist, that's my... I don't know what that is really. He sang his song, Blinded by Your Grace. You see, the thing is about sin, that the thing that so often holds us back from God is not that people are blinded by his grace, but simply blind to his grace. In verse 20, this younger brother sits among the pigs, but he decides, and it says he got up and went to his father. This bedraggled figure, covered in his poverty, starving, clothed in pig filth. And then it says, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. This is that kind of deep, gut-wrenching passion. His insides melt at the sight of his son. He was filled with compassion for him. So he breaks all the social protocols. A man like this would never be seen running in that society, but he ran to his son. And then, regardless of all the filth and the stench, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. It's hard really to describe how this embrace is so wonder-filled. The father's welcome is extravagant beyond every expectation. It's a welcome of transformation. This son is clothed with shame. He has deeply dishonored his father. He's messed everything up. Now, one writer who writes about shame, you can see the son in his description. He writes, this is shame. You are shunned. Faces are turned away from you. They ignore you as if you didn't exist. You're naked. Faces are turned towards you. They stare at you as if you were hideous. You are worthless, and it's no secret. You are of little value or of no value to those whose opinions matter to you. That's the returning son, walking back into that community, maybe dismissed by some as a beggar, or even worse, recognized for what he was, clothed in shame until he meets the embrace of his father. And in those arms and under that kiss, that shame is turned into honor. Bring the best robe, put a ring on his finger, because this is my son. The son is destitute, but in a moment his poverty comes to riches. The son is starving. And I love the bit that says, let's have a feast and celebrate. The sense is, the way that we celebrate is by eating. The son's famine becomes a feast. His sorrow becomes joy. His loneliness becomes family. His exile becomes home. That all this transformation flows from the embrace of the Father. There's nothing reluctant in what the Father does. The Father is embarrassingly eager to pour love on his Son, and he delights to do it. And in all of this, we're meant to see Jesus. It's Jesus who welcomes sinners and eats with them. It's Jesus who tells this story to explain what it is that compels him to sit at that table with the sinners. In the story, the Father rushes out to meet his Son. Now, remarkably, he goes out also to meet the older son. But it's this going out of the Father that captures the whole mission of the Christ. Now, later, he will say, "I've come to seek and to save the lost." Now, that's what Jesus is all about. That's what initiated his departure from the glories and perfections of heaven into the mess of this world. For God to take on flesh and to become man, and to be called Jesus because he would save his people from their sins, and then to live through this life, to be nailed to a cross. Suffering what he didn't deserve. Taking on himself the shame of his people. Taking in himself the punishment warranted by his people's sins. And so that in the justice of God he might secure for sinners a welcome into the embrace of the Father. No, so we could say, as John writes in his first letter, "See what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are." That's the love that held Jesus to the cross. Love that has won a way back to God from the dark paths of sin. Love that is embarrassingly eager to change our shame into honour, and our poverty into riches, and our famine into feasting, and our sorrow to joy, and our exile to home. Love that will silence our attempts to bargain with God, our attempts to pay off his debt. Love that throws itself on us with that kiss of full acceptance. So what it was that compelled Jesus to sit at that table with sinners is what we most need him to be for us today. But here we're meant to see Jesus. And of course we're meant to see ourselves. That bedraggled figure of the Son returning, covered in his poverty, starving, clothed in pig filth. That's us, isn't it? Now we might have tried to patch the mess up with some hard work and good deeds. Now, like the older brother, like the Pharisees, now, Jesus would say it another time as he sees right through them. He says they're like whitewashed tombs. They look great on the outside. They've done a good job with the outer appearance. But there's a rotting corpse in the middle. We're meant to see ourselves. And if we're not blind to grace but blinded by it, we might see ourselves being met by the Father and enveloped in that extravagant embrace of his acceptance. And his love, and his delight to have us home, his delight to say and to keep on saying, "He was dead, she was dead, but is alive. Was lost, but is found. This is my son, this is my daughter." And that is what we are. Now, this morning we've witnessed the baptisms of Adam and Andrew. And on one level, it is highly offensive what we've done. So we've declared that these two men, these two men who, like all the rest of us, are more sinful than we could bear to see, as such as these, are crowned with blessings that our wildest dreams couldn't come close to comprehend. And if there's any part of us that thinks we must work to earn a place in God's love, that is very offensive. And it's the level of the Pharisees. But in reality, what we've seen today is the blinding beauty of God's grace. Witness these two men testifying that they have been welcomed, testifying they've been gathered up in that full embrace of God through his Son, the Lord Jesus. We've testified that these sons have returned home. And so this morning we're not so much celebrating what Adam and Andrew have done, but what God has done for them and through them and in them. And through their faith, these baptisms mark them out as those who have every spiritual blessing showered on them in Christ. They are heirs of glory. Their sins are forgiven. They have a sure hope of everlasting life. By grace, they have been saved through faith. It's not their own doing. It is the gift of God. So that these baptisms declare what God has done, as the Father said in the story. We had to celebrate and be glad. Because this brother of yours, these brothers of ours, were dead and are alive again. They were lost and they're found. Jesus' story doesn't tell us how the older brother responded to all that. The ending is left open and invites us to consider how we might respond. Now, is the God who we believe in or the God who we refuse to believe in anything like the God described in Jesus' story? Or what will you do with what you've heard today?